Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to continue with an analysis of some of the relationship between fascism, eugenics, and euthanasia. This attended upon the debate currently ongoing within American legal circles and American courts concerning physician-assisted suicide. The text that you're hearing read in the segment you're about to hear begins with a section from the book Death and Deliverance, subtitled Euthanasia in Germany, 1900 to 1945, that was authored by Michael Burleigh, B-U-R-L-E-I-G-H. The book was published in softcover by the Cambridge University Press and copyrighted 1994. This program is excerpted from the One Step Beyond broadcast of January 12, 1997. The latter way of viewing these matters dovetails neatly with fashionable and nowadays orthodox, quote, structure functionalist, unquote, accounts of Nazi policymaking, i.e. the view that Nazi exterminatory policies were contingent, local, and essentially short-termist in origin, if not in ambition. This view of things conveniently overlooks some important elements in the story. First, Hans Heinrich Lammers, L-A-M-M-E-R-S, the head of the Reich Chancellery, recalled that Hitler had contemplated killing mental patients in 1933 when he was being advised on the law for the prevention of a hereditarily diseased progeny. Now, note that particular law, because we're going to come back to it later on in the program, time permitting. If not, I'm going to recap part of tonight's discussion and continue it on when time permits in a future broadcast. More about the Nazi euthanasia program and how it escalated into escalated from the Naur case. Now, bear in mind that case I just talked about in which the distress of the mother had to be relieved, according to the father. Eventually, Hitler gave permission for the child to be put to sleep. That opened the legal loophole for killing, led to the euthanasia program, which led to other extermination programs, eventually to Auschwitz. And bear in mind that many of the ideological and philosophical roots of these programs lay firmly planted in the United States. More about the extermination of now not horribly deformed babies, but other children, some of them mentally ill. Skipping ahead in the book Death and Deliverance, Euthanasia, quote, Euthanasia, unquote, in Germany, 1900 through 45. About the extermination of other children. The pediatric clinic at Brandenburg-Gurden was the jewel in the crown of the Reich Committee's 30-odd clinics. This was where the doctors who were put in charge of other clinics learned the rather elementary task of murdering children with tablets and injections. It was a regular hive of activity, with endless rounds of Binet-Simon and Rorschach tests, x-rays, and autopsies conducted on behalf of academics at a number of distinguished universities, who were barely capable of concealing their eagerness to lay hands on the jars of formaldehyde. Horst L., a hydrocephalic 11-year-old, was admitted to Gurden on October 1, 1942. He had been in various clinics and homes for half of his life, latterly in the Berlin Charité following a bout of diphtheria. The doctors there had arranged his admission to Gurden. The daily reports of the nursing staff describe a cheerful child who liked to tell stories and sang a lot. He was x-rayed and photographed in a series of positions. He described life at home. Horst L. Now, this is a kid who gets put to sleep, and check this out. Horst L. Mummy needs a helper, for she has so much to do in the kitchen, cooking, baking cakes, and therefore one needs, question, is she old or young? Horst L., young. Question, is she nice? Horst L., yes, she washes me in the morning, then gives me coffee. Then she always gets rid of the crumbs and makes the bed. I always have to stay in bed at home. Question, do you know why? Horst L., because Aunt H. cannot carry me anymore. Question, why? Horst L., yes, because I am too heavy. This again, questioning by some of the staff at the institution at which Horst is exterminated. Continuing with Burleigh's commentary, his forester father's deer hunting exploits were related in great detail, although the father tended not to talk with him much. He was clearly a mummy's boy. He recalled every detail about the family home, especially the gramophone and radio, which assumed vast importance of the life of someone perpetually confined to bed. Horst was particularly good on the entire program schedule of Radio Breslau, being able to recall the closing message, quote, we are now concluding today's broadcasts. We request our listeners to retune to the German radio, unquote. He was subjected to tests on 10, 25, 27, and the 30th of November, and on the 3rd of December. These went on interminably, although Horst seems to have looked forward to them. identifying pictures of spoons, ducks, shoes, apples, sailing ships, locomotives, wheelbarrows, buckets, cars, coffee mills, mushrooms, horses, cherries, etc., counting the fingers on his hands, the buttons on his pullover, pulling two triangles together as a rectangle, rearranging wooden building bricks and geometric figures with sticks, repeating sentences of a certain number of syllables. Quote, the dog fears the cat because it has sharp claws became the dog feared the cat, but it has black claws, unquote. The snail moves very slowly, but that is because it carries its home on its back became the snail moves very slowly and takes its whole house. Repeating rows of numbers, 3681, 3681, 93718, 93718, 25084, 25042, 298. The war formed the basis of yet more questions. Questions like, why is there a war going on, or why are they shooting, brought the response, I will ask my mummy how long the war will last. Bear in mind, this is an 11-year-old child. When his attention flagged during Rorschach tests, his vision was poor in both eyes, the doctor lost patience and held a stick in front of him by way of encouragement. These rounds of questions, which would get on anyone's nerves, although children have an amazing capacity to tolerate such things, were occasionally broken by a pause. During one of these intervals, Horst chatted with a secretary. Horst L., Miss D., I dreamed of dear God. Question, what did you dream? Horst L., he should make nice weather. Secretary, but it is very nice. Horst L., yes, but it isn't so simple. Everything passes. Question, what is not so simple? Horst L., things aren't so easy in life. I can't tell you why this is so. No, I can't. Secretary, but things are going well for you? Horst L., Miss D., things are better here than in... I know how things are, and at home, too. Mummy has a lot to do. Perhaps I'll get a visitor tomorrow. Perhaps Aunt M. and H. will come. Perhaps Aunt M. will bring something nice with her. Aunt M. came to the other ward. She brought me pears, beads, and marbles, marbles made of glass. She didn't have any more, just a couple, with which Horst had already played when he was small. By the way, this is Horst speaking. Horst would prefer to be home, but now he has to stay here. I know that the sisters are nice here, too. Yesterday, Sister L said to me as she carried me, look, Horst, you see, you are not so heavy. We can still carry you. And Sister L was right. It is very nice here. On January 12, 1943, Dr. Schumacher, S-C-H-U-M-A-C-H-E-R, the consulting neurologist, dictated a letter about Horst to be sent to the Reich Committee. Horst's evident curiosity, happiness, and imaginativeness were filtered out. He was now simply an 11-and-a-half-year-old with the intelligence of a 5-and-a-half-year-old. He would never improve and would never perform, quote, socially valuable activities, unquote, a translation, corporatism and course cost-benefit analysis as applied to human life. That's my interjection. Continuing, he recommended his, quote, treatment in line with the directive of the Ministry of the Interior, unquote. Horst died on March 5, 1943 at 10 o'clock. A suspiciously lengthy entry in his medical record on the same day attempts to fabricate a history of gradual decline. He had lost weight, stopped playing and talking to adults, and sat staring vacantly into space. All of these things apparently happened in a day. The cause of death was given as bronchial pneumonia, but the autopsy revealed nothing wrong with his lungs. The skull, the report continued, is pronouncedly larger than the rest of the organism, unquote. That had not been Horst's problem. This chapter began with the first tentative steps towards implementing a children's, quote, euthanasia, unquote, program, and has advanced to a point long after Hitler's alleged halt order of August of 1941, somewhere in 1942 and 43, at which the killing of children, adolescents, and young adults had become routine and systematic. We have seen that this came about quite deliberately as an act of moral and intellectual conviction on the part of a closely knit group of like-minded individuals. It is dogmatic, unimaginative, and perverse to talk about choices made by mature, intelligent people in terms of the automatic functioning of bureaucratic machinery. As many as 6,000 children died, although many more were killed under the adult, quote, euthanasia, unquote, program. However, the killing of handicapped children was but one aspect of a broader strategy to decimate the asylum population in general, which in turn was but one aspect of the desire to kill all that was alien, imperfect, or deviant. The rest of this chapter will be concerned with what was codenamed Axion T4, i.e. the systematic murder of mainly adult patients. So again, by way of understanding how big oaks from little acorns can grow with regard to official state murder, bear in mind what happened in Germany with that frankly very wrenching account of little Horst L. and what happened to him. And one gets to a certain extent at least a little feeling of what that admittedly deformed but still obviously to a certain extent viable child was like. Now, bear in mind that the Naur case and the directives that led to the T4 program and the, quote, euthanasia, unquote, program grew directly out of a series of eugenics laws, which in many ways had their inspiration and their counterpart in the United States. One of the key source works that I have used for the Seeds of Nuremberg archive show, a miscellaneous archive show done in the spring of 1994, was a very important book entitled The Nazi Connection, subtitled Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism. This book was authored by Stefan Kuhl, K-U-H-L, published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press, and copyrighted 1994. I'm going to read the jacket flap here very briefly. Hitler published Mein Kampf in 1924. He held up a foreign law as a model for his program of racial purification. The U.S. Immigration Restriction Act, which prohibited the immigration of those with hereditary illnesses and entire ethnic groups. When the Nazis took power in 1933, they installed a program of eugenics, the attempted, quote, improvement, unquote, of the population through forced sterilization and marriage controls that consciously drew on the U.S. example. By then, many American states had long had compulsory sterilization laws for, quote, defectives, unquote, upheld by the Supreme Court in 1927. Small wonder that the Nazi laws led one eugenics activist in Virginia to complain, quote, the Germans are beating us at our own game, unquote. In The Nazi Connection, Stefan Kuhl uncovers the ties between the American eugenics movement and the Nazi program of racial hygiene, showing that many American scientists actively supported Hitler's policies. After introducing us to the recently resurgent problem of scientific racism, Kuhl carefully recounts the history of the eugenics movement both in the United States and internationally, demonstrating how widely the idea of sterilization as a genetic control had become accepted by the early 20th century. From the first, American eugenicists led the way with radical ideas. Their influence led to sterilization laws in dozens of states, laws which were studied carefully by the German racial hygienists. With the rise of Hitler, the Germans enacted compulsory sterilization laws based partly on the U.S. experience, and American eugenicists took pride in their influence on Nazi policies. Kuhl recreates astonishing scenes of American eugenicists traveling to Germany to study the new laws, publishing scholarly articles lionizing the Nazi eugenics program, and proudly comparing personal notes from Hitler thanking them for their books. Even after the outbreak of war, he writes, the American eugenicists frowned upon Hitler's totalitarian government, but not his sterilization laws. By 1945, when the murderous nature of the Nazi government was made perfectly clear, the American eugenicists sought to downplay the close connections between themselves and the German program. Some of them, in fact, had sought to distance themselves from Hitler even before the war. But Stefan Kuhl's deeply documented book provides a devastating indictment of the influence and aid provided by American scientists for the most comprehensive attempt to enforce racial purity in world history. Now, bear in mind that one of the German laws that lay prominently in the background of Hitler's decision on the Naur case was the law for the prevention of hereditarily ill progeny. This was a law that drew heavily on a law that was passed in California in the late 1920s. And reading now from the Nazi Connection, in view of such recognition, it is not surprising that Popenoe, that's a guy named Paul Popenoe Gosney, and the California eugenics movement as a whole strongly supported the Nazi sterilization law. In 1934, the California eugenics movement organized the presentation of an exhibition of the Reich's eugenics program. The exhibition was shown during the annual meeting of the American Public Health Association and was open to the public at the Los Angeles County Museum. The newsletter of the Southern California branch of the American Eugenics Society promoted the exhibition. Quote, "It portrays the general eugenics program of the Nazi government, giving special attention to the need for sterilization. Those who have seen this exhibit say it is the finest thing of the kind that has ever been produced. Take the opportunity to see this while it is in Los Angeles. Tell your friends about it," unquote. Popenoe viewed the German sterilization law as the fulfillment of principles developed by the California movement. He remarked that, quote, "Since the Nazis came into full power, changes have been so frequent that it has been difficult to keep track of them," unquote. Yeah, I dare say that if the little Horst L. had survived, he might have made a similar statement. Continuing, he announced that the German sterilization law, which became effective on January 1, 1934, encompassed, quote, "the largest number of persons who had ever been included in the scope of such legislation at any one time," unquote. He called the German law well-conceived and argued that it could be considered superior to the sterilization laws of most American states. In a letter to L.C. Dunn, a critic of Hitler's race policy, Popenoe defended the German sterilization law. The law that has been adopted is not a half-baked and hasty improvisation of the Hitler regime, but is the product of many years of consideration by the best specialists in Germany. I must say that my impression is, from a close following of the situation in the German scientific press, rather favorable. In a scientific evaluation of sterilization laws in different countries, Popenoe identified favorable trends during the first 3 years following the application of the German sterilization law. The example of California reveals the critical role that the transfer of knowledge about medical, scientific, and political aspects of sterilization played in the formulation of Nazi sterilization legislation. However, support of the Nazi sterilization law was not limited to California eugenicists. And again, note that the sterilization laws led directly, the law for the prevention of hereditarily ill progeny, escalated gradually to the Naur case, which led to the euthanasia programs, which led to Auschwitz and all of its attendant ills. One of the things that I talked about in the aforementioned Seeds of Nuremberg program was the Pioneer Fund. The Pioneer Fund was an American eugenics organization founded in 1937. Its two founders, Harry Laughlin and Harry Osborne, were openly supportive of the Third Reich's racial legislation, and indeed Harry Laughlin had honorary degrees conferred on him by the Nazi-dominated academia of Nazi Germany. The Pioneer Fund is very active today. One of its proteges, Philippe Rushton, financed by the Pioneer Fund, had his research used as the basis for the Bell Curve, the pseudoscientific racist bestseller that was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for a long period of time. Proposition 187 in California was co-authored by a lobbyist for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. That organization has received over $1 million in Pioneer Fund funding. Bear in mind that the American Immigration Restriction Act was cited by Hitler in Mein Kampf as a model piece of legislation to ensure the, quote, racial purity, unquote, of a society. The Pioneer Fund is a functional element of political and ideological continuity from the Hitler eugenics period right on up to the eugenics of today. And again, the Bell Curve drawing on that legislation, drawing on research financed by the Pioneer Fund, a New York Times bestseller. I want to note that its co-author, Charles Murray, has an interesting background, as I've discussed in the past. He was involved with, quote, counterinsurgency research in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War. Translation, he's involved with the intelligence community, or was, and might still be. Skipping down ahead in the Nazi connection, the American eugenics movement was especially impressed by Nazi propaganda that promoted the ideals of race improvement. Harry Laughlin, again co-founder of the Pioneer Fund, that's an interjection. Harry Laughlin coordinated efforts to introduce Nazi sterilization propaganda to the American public. An enthusiastic supporter of Nazi Germany, he had collected newspaper clippings about the National Socialists even before their rise to power in 1933. On the margin of a clipping concerning the opening of a Nazi racial bureau for eugenic sterilization, the words, "Hitler should be made honorary member of the ERA, Eugenics Research Association," are written. Laughlin also used his position as assistant director of the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Spring Harbor to organize the dissemination of Nazi race propaganda. He was impressed by the modern methods of Nazi race propaganda,
especially by the use of films as a persuasive medium for propagating eugenic goals. In 1936, Laughlin purchased an English version of the movie Erbkrank, or Hereditary Defective, an important sterilization propaganda film of the racial political office of the Nazi Party, in order to show it at the Carnegie Institution in Washington. Erbkrank, which the Nazi censor administration evaluated as, quote, national political valuable, unquote, and which received, quote, the particular acknowledgement of the Führer, unquote, was the basis of a large propaganda campaign in Germany. The film is introduced by a quote from Walter Gross, director of the Racial Policy Office. Quote, a people that builds palaces for the descendants of drunks, criminals, and idiots, and which at the same time houses its workers and farmers in miserable huts, is on the way to rapid self-destruction, unquote. Among other pictures of mentally handicapped people, the film shows, quote, four feeble-minded siblings, unquote, who have cost the state, quote, together during more than 80 years of institutionalization, 153,000 marks, unquote. One subtitle claims that, quote, many idiots are deep under the animal, unquote. The film concludes with a statement, quote, that the prevention of hereditarily sick offspring is a moral duty and means, quote, the highest respect for the God-given natural laws, unquote. The film ends with a picture of a man and a woman planting with a subtitle, the farmer who prevents the overgrowth of the weed promotes the valuable, unquote. Laughlin described the movie as confined to the, quote, problem of hereditary degeneracy in the fields of feeble-mindedness, insanity, crime, hereditary disease, and inborn deformity, unquote. He stated that the film, quote, contrasts the squalid living conditions of normal children in certain German city slums with the finer and costly modern custodial institutions built for the care of handicapped persons produced by the socially inadequate and degenerate, accompanied by captions explaining the family history and description of the near kin of the particular subject. Although the film propagated the notion that Jews were particularly susceptible to mental retardation and moral deviancy, Laughlin asserted in Eugenic News that the picture contained, quote, no racial propaganda of any sort, unquote. The film's sole purpose, he argued, was to, quote, educate the people in the matter of soundness of family stock quality, physical, mental, and spiritual, regardless of race, unquote. Impressed by the film's powerful effect on the audience at the Carnegie Institution, Laughlin decided to use a slightly altered version of Erbkrank to help educate the wider American public about race improvement. His assistant, Alice M. Helmer, H-E-L-L-M-E-R, informed the SS Office for Race and Settlement about this plan. Laughlin raised money to fund the distribution of the film's edited version entitled Eugenics in Germany to churches, clubs, colleges, and high schools. Laughlin wrote to the millionaire Wycliffe Draper, quote, if this film reflects accurately the policy of modern Germany, that nation in this particular field of applied negative eugenics has evidently made substantial progress in its intention to act fundamentally on a long-term plan for the prevention, so far as possible, of hereditary degeneracy. Draper and his Pioneer Fund undertook to finance the distribution of the Nazi movie. In cooperation with the Eugenics Research Association, the Eugenics Record Office sent a flyer advertising the film to biology teachers in 3,000 high schools. The Pioneer Fund, the Eugenics Record Office, and the Eugenics Research Association anticipated a favorable response because of the attractive medium and the low cost to viewers. The movie played 28 times between March 15th, 1937, and December 10, 1938. Although plans for national distribution were never realized, the Nazi press reported that Erbkrank had been a success in the United States. An article in a Nazi newspaper entitled, and I'm not going to attempt the German, Racial Political Propaganda in the German Model Receives Great Attention Among American Scientists, reported that the movie had made a, quote, exceptionally strong impression, unquote, on American eugenicists. Why did the eugenics movement in the United States as a whole, ranging from the modern eugenicists to the race anthropologists around Madison Grant, express such enthusiasm for the Nazi sterilization law? In view of the American eugenicists, the Nazi government had avoided mistakes that were made in the formulation of sterilization laws in the different states of their own nation. The German government had introduced a nationwide, well-conceived law, unlike the heterogeneous, improvised state laws in America. American eugenicists also viewed the law on preventing hereditarily ill progeny as grounded on scientific results. And as Michael Burley points out in his book on euthanasia, it was that law that served as the basis for Hitler's behavior in the Nauer case. One concluding item, and I'm going to resume this at greater length when we have time for the discussion. Research credit on the following goes to a sharp-eyed listener who picked this up from the Science and Technology section of the San Jose Mercury News of December 31st of 1996. Euthanasia drug patent includes use on humans. The first patent for a euthanasia drug combination with potential human use, developed by Michigan State University with research money from a giant German chemical company, has been granted in Europe. In April, the European Patent Office granted an application filed by the university for a, quote, euthanasia composition, unquote, originally intended for animals, which was developed by its scientists with more than $350,000 in research grants from American subsidiaries of the German company Hoechst AG. That's H-O-E-C-H-S-T. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Though the patent applies to, quote, to killing, quote, mammals, unquote, such as dogs and horses, it also would allow the drug compound to be used for human beings in any European Economic Community nation that legalizes doctor-assisted suicide or euthanasia, patent documents show. University officials acknowledge that they worded the European patent on their euthanasia compound to include humans to cover the possibility of legalization. But they now say they have no intention of allowing anyone to use the drugs for that purpose. I would say take that with a generous grain of salt. By the way, Hoechst AG, that German company that provided the grants for Michigan State University to develop that euthanasia drug, that is a very, very interesting company indeed. The last item I'm going to read, I'm going to do this very quickly. This is from the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning, a colleague of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite at CBS during World War II, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart and copyright 1981. The Hoechst Company, or Hoechst, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, or Hoechst, is one of the companies of the old IG Farben company, the backbone of Hitler's war production and much of the political support for Hitler, and the company that developed the Zyklon B for use in the gas chambers at the concentration camp. Of the breakup of IG Farben by the Allies, Manning writes, "By 1950, emphasis was on a strong West Germany and industrial recovery, and it was finally decided that the IG plants should be reorganized into three companies, BASF, the Bayerische Annalen und Sodefabrik, Bayer, Fabrenfabriken von Friedrich Bayer and Company, and Hoechst, or Hoechst, Fabrike von Meister Lucius und Brüning." The point is, the company that has developed this patent for a euthanasia drug at Michigan State University is IG Farben. IG Farben, of course, returning live to in-studio, was the Nazi chemical cartel that, among other things, manufactured the Zyklon B for the concentration camps. That concludes this segment. Listeners interested in pursuing more information should contact Spitfire for additional archival references. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.